From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Our first guest this morning is Dr. Lauren Strawn. She's a biologist living here in Park City who has a passion for science education. So in college, she decided to pursue biology as a career after being transfixed by the Human Genome Project. She earned her PhD in neurobiology and anatomy from the University of Utah. She has worked in both academic and industry labs, as well as for nonprofit science education projects like the Natural History of Genes and BioEyes. And we talked to her about BioEyes a couple of years ago. She also volunteers at McPullen Elementary to help run their science fair each year, where her daughter and two nieces are attending. And she joins us today to give us an update on where we are with CRISPR gene editing and an update also on the research she was doing with BioEyes, as well as, gosh, any other cellular biology updates we may want, or science in general. So welcome, Lauren Strawn, to Cool Science Radio. Great to have you.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks, John.
So, Lauren, I don't know how many people can say that they were transfixed by the Human Genome Project. Why don't we start there? What is it, and why were you so transfixed?
So I think in 1987 or 88, a book called Genome came out. And this book covered the scientists, the story behind the scientists who came up with the idea to sequence the human genome. Everybody had wanted to do this, but the technology wasn't available. And interestingly, these scientists were at the University of Utah at the medical school. And it was their brilliance that really gave the world the first look at the human genome. In the late 80s, this was sort of like discovering the structure of DNA. This was a really, really big deal. Now, of course, you know, there's 23andMe, you can send in a vial of spit. Yeah. But I was very, very intrigued by that. And then headed off to college where I thought I wanted to be a biomedical engineer. After nearly failing all of my engineering classes and getting an A+ in biology, it was pretty clear what my major should be. And then it's just been, you know, straight from there. Biology is my passion.
Well, what a time to be involved in biology. And by the way, I have a hard time believing you actually failed any of your engineering classes, but we'll go with that. Anyway, you were interested in biology. And I've never seen someone so turned on by all of these areas of cellular biology and looking at the human genome, and now talking about what we thought we might talk about today is CRISPR technology and where we're going with that. So, and then it also, I just think it ties into what you're doing with science education, like at a local level at McPullen Elementary, turning kids on to science. What do you think what is that hook for turning kids or adults onto science?
Well, for me, it was a very well-written book. It wasn't necessarily my science teacher, although she was great, and I still do remember AP Biology having to learn exactly how you would digest a Big Mac. But it was really an author, I guess, and words that showed me that this was as big as space. This was this huge field left to be explored. Nobody had really cracked the code. And so if, you know, you have a curious mind, that's what you're looking for, is some big puzzle to work on. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what excites kids too, that there's more than just the memorization part of science, you know, that there's really a big world out there full of questions.
And in that big world with so many developments in science and technology, there's something very unique about the intersection of molecular biology and computer science. There's more going on there right now, and I think, personal opinion, that that's driven from the Human Genome Project, which has sort of opened the door to allow, for an example, some folks we had on back in April that went back many millions of years and looked at all these great apes, mandrills, chimpanzees, gorillas, human beings, and found that there are some great apes that do not have autoimmune diseases. And when they did the genome from many years ago on these animals and compared them to the humans, they found that there was this one unique protein that they have that we don't have. And so there's some possibilities there that they may be able to, by introducing that protein, it's going through trials right now, that they may be able to stop a number of really significant diseases. So it's the upside at this intersection is very exciting. What sort of things are you seeing at this particular inflection point?
Well, to bring CRISPRs back up again, CRISPRs are highly dependent on computer science. It's not a scientist that's actually designing the CRISPR; it's a program, and you have to run the program a couple times to get good ones. And one of the things I wanted to bring up was that the woman who discovered the CRISPR technology and who figured out how to harness the technology, she was a basic biologist for many, many years, just toiling away in her little lab at Berkeley on microbiology, study of bacteria. But what made her different is that she did her postdoc with Thomas Cech, who's an incredibly famous crystallographer, which means you study the structure of protein. This takes a very big microscope and a very big computer to look at the structure of the protein. And that's really important because from the structure, you can figure out the function. And so it was that skill that she had, that crystallography skill, that allowed her to realize that this CRISPR-Cas9 complex that she was studying in bacteria actually could be used to apply to genetic engineering in human cells. Without actually seeing the structure, I'm not sure that idea would have popped into your head intuitively. But the structure literally looks like scissors. Like it cleaves DNA. So it's very intuitive.
Is bacteria a component of the DNA sequence? Or is it just used in the editing process?
Okay, so it's a dog-eat-dog world, right? Even bacteria get viral infections. Even bacteria get colds. And the viruses, the way that they want to replicate themselves and win, is that they insert their DNA into the bacterial DNA and wait for the bacterial DNA to just churn out more viruses for them. And they insert their DNA at CRISPR sites. That's where the word comes from, the name comes from. And if you want to know what CRISPR stands for, it's kind of ridiculous. It's clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats. This is why you shouldn't let scientists come up with acronyms.
Yeah.
So CRISPR it's sort of like a flag on the bacterial DNA for both the virus to know where to insert its DNA, but also for the bacterial defense system to come in and go, oh, there's my cold. Oh, I got to get that out. I got to get that out. And the protein that is going through and looking for all the CRISPR sites is called Cas9. And what Jennifer Doudna and her colleagues figured out in 2012 was that you could harness the CRISPR-Cas9 complex to not just cut viral DNA out of bacteria, but to, for example, cut viral DNA out of human cells, so like HIV DNA. And this this is what really led to a lot of excitement.
And what's the current status on being able to eradicate HIV virus with the CRISPR technology?
So that is a very tangled issue. So let's start from the stem cell problem. Every cell has its own genome. So if you want to change the genetics of a whole human and eradicate HIV from every single cell, or at least every cell in the blood, you need to get all those cells together and then hope that your CRISPR gene editing technique will have 100% efficiency. This is not the case right now. In adult cells, you can get about 5% efficiency right now. What the scientist in China did that really is outside of what the scientific community considers okay is he got around that efficiency issue by starting with an embryo. And then you can imagine, you know, I'm a 3 trillion cell individual versus an embryo with, you know, 100,000 cells. So your math is just that much easier. Plus, an embryo, those cells are going to go, they're going to divide and become that organism. And once you make the change, then it's passed on to every cell. Whereas as an adult, we're kind of done already. We're whole. So genetic engineering of embryos is still a no-no. We don't know enough to do that.
Mm, that is crazy. So for those of us lay people, let's take a step backwards. So there may be some of our listeners that are going, you know, I think at this point we've all heard about CRISPR gene editing. But I think that the simplest way of visualizing it is you've got a Word document and you've misspelled a word. So you can go back and highlight that word and you can take the scissors, right? The literal scissors, and take out a letter that you shouldn't have put in there or add a letter. And so this would be sort of the way you're looking at, as you describe, sort of going in with the scissors, flagging with the Cas9, and inserting or taking out.
Yes.
Right? So so we're talking about the latest, and literally this has been out for like 24 hours, the most recent news about what they're doing in China with HIV. But they're taking, so inserting stem cells from an embryo into these men who have HIV, a couple, no.
Okay. So in the adults that they're trying to eradicate HIV from, they're starting with the blood. And so imagine a blood cancer patient. You have your bone marrow is completely eradicated, usually by irradiation, so that you're set to get a bone marrow infusion. And that's where your blood stem cells are from. So if you have cancer of the blood, you get rid of all your blood, therefore getting rid of all the cancer, and then you start over with a new fresh set of blood. And that is what they did for, I think the patient is in Berlin. And the way they figured it out was, they had another patient, that patient knew another patient who had never gotten HIV, though they knew each other, and it was strange that the patient hadn't gotten HIV. And his genome was sequenced, and it turned out he was missing, or he had a mutation in a gene called CCR5.
Okay.
And so he became the donor. He gave his blood stem cells to the other patient that had HIV. And now that patient not only was cured of the cancer, but also the HIV.
Right.
But I want to back up a little bit to explain the power of CRISPR technology in terms of this analogy you had with the Word document.
Mm-hmm.
So we've known for a long time that diseases are caused by mutations in our DNA. And the way to study those diseases is to try to mimic that mutation. Well, it used to be literally like, imagine just taking like a paint gun and just, you know, hitting the Word document, and you got all these little dots everywhere. And you're like, you do that 100 times and you hope you only hit the document with one little paint splatter. And then you hope that that one little paint splatter landed right on the word that you needed to change. You know, it was literally that basic and hard to do. It got a little bit better in maybe, this is very, very recent, in maybe 2009 when they came up with zinc fingers and something else called TALENs. And those were slightly more targeted. So now let's imagine you could get to the right line of the Word document, but within that line was still pretty much a, you know, draw shut. Lucky if you got the right word. The big, big, big jump with CRISPR is that now not only can you get exactly to the right word and down to the right letter, but if you wanted to change that word out and put in a new word, you could do that. And that has never been able to be done before. And so you want to think about it as like, oh, I could go in and I could fix all these things. But really the more powerful thing is that you can break things. And when you break things, that's how you figure out how to fix them. And so that is what the work we did with the zebrafish, where we literally broke the gene that causes adrenal leukodystrophy in humans. We did this in zebrafish so that we could study adrenal leukodystrophy in the fish as opposed to a two-year-old child.
Right. And that was the BioEyes project that we talked to you about maybe three or four years ago, it seems like, a while ago. Where is that project now?
So BioEyes is an offshoot of the zebrafish research community at the University of Utah. And it actually is a consortium of like eight different schools where researchers in the zebrafish community have realized, man, these fish are really simple, real basic, and kids can understand them. And so we can use this fish to teach genetics to second, fifth, and eighth graders. And it's those grades because that's what aligns with the core curriculum. But, you know, kids are amazed that if you say, you know, my genome is 10 books and the fish's genome is 10 books, well, how many books do you think we have in common? Seven. Seven of those books between the fish and the human are exactly alike. So there's a lot to learn.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Lauren Strawn. She's a biologist. She lives here in Park City, has a passion for science and science education, works with the kids over at McPolin Elementary with Science Fair. And Lynn, I've certainly heard the word analogy of search and replace and those sorts of things. And I've also heard the statement that it's God's red pencil. And what I like about this is that there aren't 50 or 60 people working on this somewhere. There are thousands of people who are working and experimenting with CRISPR, with stem cells, and it's fascinating. And we're just starting to scratch the surface. There's some little bit of rhetoric out there as far as what it can do and what it can't do. And there's some things that you know, maybe. And I understand why people are enthusiastic about it, but there's a lot of work to be done, isn't there?
There is, although the pace is just remarkable. I mean, 2015 is when Jennifer Doudna gave her TED Talk. Mm-hmm. And so 2012 is when she first published. 2014, they're still arguing with Harvard over the patent. 2015, she gives her TED Talk. She says, I think in the next 10 years, this is going to be in human clinical trials. And it's 2019 now, and we're well into human clinical trials. They've been going a year and a half. So, yeah, the pace is really remarkable. And that stems slightly from the ease with which you can create your CRISPRs. Also, the fact that, you know, imagine being a bunch of surgeons and all you had were like these big butcher knives. And one day somebody shows up with a scalpel. It'd be life changing, right? It'd totally change the profession. That's exactly what has happened. And so everybody, you know, who wants to do surgery with a butcher knife? Everybody's picked up the scalpel. And that then has also led to the big boom.
And putting CRISPR off to the side, I know the CRISPR and stem cells are very much related in the work that is done with both of those. But let's just give us an update on stem cells, because we've spoken about that quite a bit with you before.
Yeah. Well, you know, stem cell is a tricky word. The most scientists listening to me right now, or at least biologists, would probably be horrified that I'm using the term stem cell so loosely. If you think about it, a stem cell is a cell that has the ability to give rise to different cell types. But there's not just one level of stemness. So like the fertilized embryo, that's called a totipotent stem cell, because that one single cell could go on to produce a whole human. So it's totipotent.
And that's controversial.
And then, you know, you get into the blastula stage where now you're like a ball of, you know, 100 some odd cells. And this is when you get pluripotent stem cells. And these stem cells can give rise to just about any cell in the body, but they weren't number one, right? They weren't the totipotent. And then stem cells in today, like right now, you and I are sitting here and our skin is turning over. And so there are stem cells in our skin. And those would be actually not stem cells. They're called progenitor cells.
Okay.
So, there's just a lot of loose vocabulary. Everybody likes to refer to a stem cell as a cell that has the ability to give rise to other cells. But it's actually a quite specific vocab term.
And we're not trying to reproduce any bodies. Typically, somebody has an organ, a specific organ that needs some work. So and correct me if I'm wrong here, totipluri is a cell unique to that organ stem cell, so that the totipluri cells can add a lot of value, there's a lot of utility there in that particular cell for that particular organ.
Yeah, so totipotent, that's just the fertilized egg, so we don't really need to focus on that one. Pluripotent would be like what you're talking about. And the blood is one of the easiest organs to understand. It's hard to think of the blood as an organ, but it is your circulatory system, right? It's considered discrete. And you can drain the blood out of an individual. Obviously, they need to be on life support. But you can take the whole organ out and then replace it. And you can't do that with bones or skin or the brain or the heart or lung or anything like that. So the blood has been where we've really been studying stem cells for the longest. And that work started with Irving Weissman in the 70s in Stanford. And that was really where we learned most of our stem cell biology.
It's really interesting now, I think, that stem cell therapy is on the market where you can go down. I mean, there are probably 10 places in Park City where you can have stem cells injected into your knee. And so it's coming to sort of this mass marketplace where people are starting to understand, or maybe they aren't. And I guess maybe that's my question. Do we understand going from I think the most successful stem cell therapy that you can get is it's the progenitor cells, and they're usually harvested from your own blood.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that as a scientist? And you see this being, you know, mass marketed.
Yeah. So I'm not a medical doctor. I've had friends ask me, should I go get this done? My first instinct is no. I'm pretty risk averse, but going into not a hospital setting, having many of my cells removed, spun down in a centrifuge and placed back into my body, again, not in a hospital setting, I think it's just rife for trouble. Many people think that it works and it's great, and you'll hear them say, oh, this is fantastic. But do we understand exactly how it's working? No, I don't think so. And why does it only work for some people and not for others? There's actually a lot more evidence of this sort of joint therapy working in dogs.
And no idea why that is.
That there's more research there than there is in humans.
Yeah.
So maybe we can let the veterinary world teach us a little bit more before we start becoming our own.
We could talk to you for hours. We only have a few minutes left, unfortunately. And I wanted to talk to you about the science fair at McPolin that you direct. And you're also the director of the Green Team, the recycling program there. But I wanted to ask you, we remember our science fairs from when we were kids and what the kids are doing now. How successful have we been in hooking kids into loving science to the extent that they're coming up with some really creative science fair projects?
So John was mentioning the movie Science Fair, which came to last year's Sundance and was, or maybe it was 2 years ago. It was absolutely incredible. And I think one of the important things that movie showed the community is that oftentimes we focus on these, gifted and talented kids and we push them into STEM careers and so forth. But the movie Science Fair was actually, a lot of those kids are kind of misfits. The math kid that reprogrammed his Texas Instruments calculator to create random Shakespearean insults when you would press a button, he flunked out. He he was failing, but he was obviously a genius. And I'm not encouraging us to really look, you know, force the gifted and talented kids off to the side. I'm just saying that really science is for everybody. And that movie really showed that it's not just kind of the classical nerd in a classroom. It's anybody. Anybody with curiosity is successful at science.
I'd love to throw one thing on the table before we let you go. And it's a big subject, but, you know, I'm sure we can sort of net it out quickly. We're social animals, and intuitively, we've all known that being around each other and having dogs, this is all good for us. And there's now some scientific data that actually backs that up. And we have this intuitive belief that that's true. But I believe, and we were talking about this in the green room earlier, that for the first time, there's empirical data that supports the fact that optimism, which we've all sort of intuitively thought was good for all of us, but for the first time, there's empirical data that suggests that this really adds to longevity of one's life. Can we talk about that just for a minute?
Yeah, I think the thing I'd like to say about that recent finding is that science for a long time has been influenced by Western science models, and it's really indigenous peoples that are starting to inform us about what we would call like a more inclusive scientific viewpoint. And I recently heard this woman, she's an indigenous anthropologist, but her point was that Western science really only focuses on two of the four aspects of our existence. The four aspects of our existence are brain, body, heart, and spirit. But in Western science, we really only focus on brain and body. And I would say that this recent optimism finding, where optimistic people, regardless of socioeconomic status, health factors like smoking, drinking, alcohol, that if you're an optimistic person, you have an 11 to 15% higher chance of living to 85 and beyond. And so to me, that's just screaming, well, there's the heart and spirit aspect of science that's for so long been ignored. So it's exciting to think that more inclusive approaches to scientific knowledge could really teach us a lot more.
We need optimism right now, don't we? Don't
we, Lynn? Cup half full.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
Great
Thanks,
to have
Lynn.
You back. And, you know, Lynn, I was thinking about this when Lauren was speaking. She can go in a lot of different directions on a number of different subjects. We should have her back on sometime and take some calls from our listening audience.
I like that. That's a great idea. Let's schedule the date. Lauren Strawn.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute. We'll be right back.